Hello and welcome to the EcoNews Report. We're your hosts, Kirk Cahoon
and David Narum
of Greenway Partners. Joining us today is Larry Goldberg, the community facilitator for the Transition Initiative, also known as Humboldt Village. What are we talking about here? What is a Transition Initiative?
A Transition Initiative actually started in England about 5 years ago. A fellow named Rob Hopkins began a program looking at energy resiliency and self-sustaining capabilities of a community. He looked at all of the issues that we're concerned about with climate change and with what's called peak oil, and started getting concerned that the government and others weren't addressing the problem. They felt that they needed a local solution. Thus began the process of what are called transition towns, and now they're called transition initiatives, where communities are getting organized to lower their energy footprint and become more localized. In a technical way we say it is we support our communities through the loss of the familiar and inspire and create a new lower energy infrastructure, which is ultimately an improvement on what we have today, and do it in a much more conscientious way.
What do you mean by loss of the familiar?
I like that term. The loss of the familiar is, let's talk about gas. That's a good way to think about it. Everyone freaks out when gas prices go up. And so we know right now gas prices are heading up, and everyone is programmed to think, wow, when will we ever get back to $3 a gallon? The answer is never. The thing we need to think about is that there is a ratcheting process, and it's not just happening on fuel prices, but it's happening on our economy. It's happening with global climate change. It's happening with all these things. So we have a Hurricane Katrina, and then we say, well, we're glad that's over. Now let's get back to normal. Well, this is the new normal. Normal is changing. And the world as we know it is not going to be as familiar as we remember it. It's going to be changing rapidly. To deal with that rapid change, we're creating transition communities and transition initiatives to help cope with change and move to the next level.
Larry, you mentioned a term that I'm not sure that all of the listeners are familiar with, being peak oil.
Yes. Peak oil is a term that's been used for many years. When oil was first discovered, it was considered to be virtually unlimited. But anything that comes out of the earth has a finite limitation. In the 1960s, there was an oil scientist, and he actually worked for one of the major oil companies, and his name was M. King Hubbard. He devised a engineering analysis that said the rate of discovery is not increasing at the same rate of consumption. They came up with a bell curve. You have a curve that slopes from bottom up and then it goes back down again. So when you look at the energy production, specifically oil in the United States, M. King Hubbard had a graph that said we're going to reach peak oil in America sometime between 1973 and 1975. So we are no longer producing as much as we consume. We are an energy importer. Now the question is, where does the peak occur for the world? Well, many people have been studying this, and good, well-grounded scientists are saying we are or are shortly going to be at peak oil for the world at this time. It was predicted to be sometime between 2003 and 2010. Let's just say we are either in it or very close to it right now.
Okay, and that probably is driven by a confluence of factors, including those that have been left out of the global economy, places like China and India, even Brazil, that suddenly have economies that are demanding more and more energy. So it's not just the discovery of new oil, it's also the increased consumption on a global level of oil that's driving this peak.
See, part of the problem is our industrialization process is not just growing, it's growing exponentially. And anything that grows exponentially is uncontrollable. In fact, anything that goes up vertical has a tendency to crash. And whether that's population or whether there's a lot of different things within the biological and resource limitations of nature, meaning that when you run out, it's not a matter of running out overnight, but it runs out very quickly and it has a cascading effect that one thing leads to another. And in this case, look at the way we live. Everything in our lives, plastics, medicine, food, transportation requires increasing amounts of energy to be able to facilitate it. And we have taken this inheritance and we've essentially burned through it in a couple hundred years.
We've had discussions in the past about this book by Meadows et al., commissioned by the Club of Rome back in the 70s, called Limits to Growth. And I just recently read a piece in the New Scientist, sort of a review of this book. And I do believe that there's another edition coming out this year, the 40th anniversary of its publication. It's sort of a retrospective view on some of the predictions of this model, although they wouldn't call them predictions. I was reading this piece in the New Scientist, and they're talking about one of the things to take home from their analysis is not so much, in fact, that it was a prediction necessarily, but that this tendency of when you have an exponential consumption growth in the face of a finite resource, that you tend to have what they call overshoot and inevitable collapse, that we just simply can't support these types of things indefinitely, just the nature of a finite resource. And one of the ideas was that one of their conclusions, as the authors note, the most important one would be that there's often delays in understanding before we address these problems. And so like in the issue of climate change, you know, we have this delay of sort of public awareness and understanding and action for some of these impacts that could be, you know, centuries in the unfolding. Do you want to talk a little bit about...
Sure. I think you've really hit the nail on the head. One of the things that I'd like to talk about is what I call a flywheel effect, that much like a flywheel in a car, it has momentum of its own. Once the systems are moving forward, I like to think of it like the cartoon character of the Roadrunner. You know how the Roadrunner can sometimes run and the coyote goes running after it and it goes out into thin air and it's still running? That's what I call the flywheel effect. You could be out in thin air, literally off the ground, because of the momentum, but sooner or later, gravity takes over.
And you mean this to say that so policies and our economy, in other words, are dependent upon a way that we've been doing things for so long, so much momentum, and now we have a big shift and a big change coming up. So what are we left with? I mean, at this point in time, you've identified this transition initiative.
Okay. Well, there's a point that I want to also make, and that is we tend, as a culture, to think about all of these problems as discrete, separate issues. So for example, we think about climate change. We think, oh, that's terrible. What are we going to do about that? Then we think about peak oil and, oh, that's terrible. What are we going to do about that? And then we talk about economic, you know, instability and some say collapse. And what are we going to do about that? The thing we need to think about, they're all interrelated. They're all part of the same situation. The climate change, the economic instability, and the peak oil are all part and parcel of the same thing, and it has to do with the limits to growth. There are limits to what you can take out of a finite system before Mother Nature bites back. So one of the things that we're looking at now is how to deindustrialize. I came up with a term the other day, you know, about the Industrial Revolution. We are beginning now the deindustrial revolution. We need to find a way to do more with less. And so if gas goes to $5, $6, $10, $15, $20 a gallon, it's obvious that we can't live the way we live. So a big reaction to that, there's going to be panic, there's going to be all kinds of, you know, buying and selling, and people are going to be trying to find a way around it. The best solution is community-based solutions to learn now to be able to downscale our needs and to adjust to the coming changes rather than having them hit us as a shock treatment.
So, Larry, are you saying that thorium mining on the moon and chipping thorium back to the planet from the moon and nuclear using thorium in a nuclear reaction is an unsustainable technological solution?
I'll put it this way. Many people who know me, if I've lived up here 32 years now, know that I'm Mr. Tech. I started the internet service up here, commercial internet. I've been involved in technology for many years, and I really love technology. I've been involved in alternative energy. I'm a tech guy, but I'm the first one to tell you, tech is not going to solve our problems. We can't build it fast enough, and we don't have enough resources at this time to fix it. There's a nice quote that I like in one of these books. It says, there's a difference between a problem and a predicament. A problem can be addressed. A predicament needs to be lived with. In the late 70s, early 80s, we had an energy problem. I was involved at that time in trying to address it, and we were looking at doing solar and wind and renewables and all kinds of stuff. And we as a country addressed those issues then. It might have been a problem that could have been resolved. We're 30, 40 years down the line now. Now we're looking at a predicament. The predicament is there are no easy solutions. It's not going to end pretty if we don't get ready for some big changes.
Well, so much of what you're talking about, Larry, this culture in America seems to be so much geared around the individual. And in fact, the shared sacrifice mantra that Jimmy Carter was proposing, and people should wear a cardigan instead of turning up the heat to save energy during my childhood in the mid-70s, you know, it seems like we're up against our individualistic streak in this country to try to get change. So if you're trying to do something here with a group of people, I mean, this almost seems like you're trying to do a grassroots sort of bottom-up approach. And I'm wondering, what do you foresee as some of the challenges to getting some of these ideas adopted into policymaking, into the organizational and institutional structure that really directs this country, unfortunately?
Well, much of the movement is inspired by the nonviolence movement and some of the peace movements of, you know, the last 100 years. And one of the people, is one of my heroes, is Gandhi. And Mahatma Gandhi said a beautiful thing. He said, "You must be the change you want to see in the world." And I think that what we are trying to do is live the change as a demonstration. We are going to, through our actions, start doing the things that need to be done with the hope that others will catch on and start doing it too.
This area, this rural area, is so heavily dependent upon oil and gasoline and diesel for transportation. Like most areas that are rural in the country, economically, people live in West Haven, they live in Trinidad, they live in Willow Creek, and they commute to where they work. So much of what we count on now as the Humboldt way of life is obviously unsustainable when we talk about increased fuel costs. So how does this problem or predicament, as you're suggesting, be resolved?
Okay, so let's talk about transportation as a specific example. We formed a group recently. This came out of the Occupy movement, and our group that's kind of splintered off from that is called Humboldt Village. And we look at Humboldt Village as the beginning of a transition initiative for Humboldt County. And Humboldt Village is starting to do a bunch of little initiatives to help make, you know, the change we want to see. One of the initiatives we're working on right now as we speak is ride sharing. We're looking at the idea that if you have to go from Trinidad to Eureka, you can't drive with an empty car. We must be sharing a ride. So it's not a big deal to get a ride to go with you when you go into Eureka, do your shopping, do whatever, and then come back that evening. Ride sharing is a natural thing. And think about, like, if we had to ration gas or had to ration whatever we have, how would you get to town? You'd all get together and go together, or you take the bus. Or you wait and you only go once a week. So in other words, there are things that we take as a given. I'm going to get in my car and drive to Eureka every day, and we don't have to do that. And to some degree, the technology that we have today is liberating. I work in technology where I can do telecommuting from home. The most radical thing you can do is stay home. I mean, if you really want to make a change, stop driving. If you stop driving one day a week, just one day a week, that is a tremendous amount of energy. Do it 2 days a week. Look how much more you'd save. If we have a five-day work week and you don't drive one day a week, you've just saved 20% of your energy consumption. So there are simple things that can be done today that don't require nuclear fusion, that don't require reinventing, you know, the wheel. We have these abilities right now, but we just have to organize. So we have to have a way so people know, I'm driving into town today. Do you want a lift? Anybody can check up on whether Craigslist or some other system to see if there's a ride available and grab a ride. It's easy.
I'm going to take us back to the limits to growth idea, just because that's sort of the foundation of, you know, the issues regarding peak oil. And it sort of started the conversation, I think, quite a long time ago about, you know, the limits to our current way of living. And back to this New Scientist article, which basically tried to make the point that the limits to growth was in some ways misunderstood by many people. And often one group sort of claimed that it had been completely discredited, but they were discrediting something that the authors would claim that they didn't really say. And one of the key ideas was regarding these sort of delays in response that society has because we kind of like to continue doing the same thing and like all of a sudden we have to adapt, was that innovation would sort of help or could possibly help us to avert the problems. And, you know, what that means is anybody's guess. Innovation could be exactly what the transition initiatives are doing, or it could be something like a high-tech, you know, global energy solution. But you might remember Julian Simon, The Economist, and economists had big problems with this idea of limits to growth because they figured Julian Simon was famous for, you know, arguing in favor of population growth because that would be more brains on the planet to solve the problems that more brains cause or more people cause. Sort of an interesting argument, but I'm just wondering on the scale of the kinds of innovations that you see the transition initiatives beginning, do you believe that's adequate or do we have to start somewhere? Is that sort of the idea? Because we're talking about large scale technological infrastructure.
Let's put it this way. One of the driving principles of the transition initiative movement is what we call relocalization, and that's already underway. The idea of producing more of your food locally, producing more of your energy locally, producing more of the things you consume locally. In addition, we're also talking about other forms of currency or other forms of governance, other forms of culture. There are things that have been done in the past that can be done again today to allow us to build a resilient society that is not prone to these, you know, ups and downs and crises and all this other stuff. There is a way to be more resilient, but it is not based on consumerism. It's not based on just buying more and more stuff. It's based on finding a comfort level from being with the rest of our community and having enough for everybody. And that is a real change in outlook.
You're listening to the Econews Report. I'm your host, Kirk Cahoon, here with David Narum of Greenway Partners. And with us on the line is Larry Goldberg, a community facilitator with the Transition Initiatives and the Humboldt Village program. So, Larry, I want to point something out in our discussion so far. We've talked about bringing this stuff back to the people and having relocalization happen, where we're devolving power from these institutions and organizations down to the people. And there's such an uneven playing field now in this culture, and perhaps it's been this way in forever, and maybe we're just aware of it more now. But it seems like the world has really awakened in the last year or two to the fact that they actually have a lot more power as just people outside of a government or institution than they used to have. And that seems to really be, if you look at the Middle East, if you look at what the Occupy movement's been doing, if you look at, you know, people foreclosing, going in and squatting in foreclosed homes, whatever it is, there seems to be this awareness of the power that individual people or small groups of people actually have. So what do you think is driving that?
Well, I actually think that this is a natural bubbling up of the creative talents of people in response to an untenable situation.
But it's happening globally. So to me, there's this mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore moment that's being enabled by something. And is it technology that it's enabling it?
I'd like to think of it as synergy. I like to think of it as this is a synergistic time where a lot of cross currents are coming to a head and people see this. They're not blind. And I think that let's just talk about here in America. We see that our government is in gridlock. We can't get anything through Congress. They're not doing the kind of changes that need to happen. And I don't know that they can. And to be honest with you, I don't necessarily think that any political party has the answer. I think they are all driven by Wall Street. They're driven by, you know, the same basic assumptions that there are no limits to growth. No one could get elected if they said there's limits to growth. So it's really up to people to come up with their own solutions, and that's what's happening worldwide. Now, with that said, it's not going to be painless. I mean, when you look at the Arab Spring and you look at what's going on all over the world, there is a revolution taking place, and revolutions tend to get messy. But in order for us to transition to the next level, we are going to have to shed our skin. We're going to have to change, and change is the one thing no one wants to do. The transition movement tries to make it a little more painless.
Well, and the one thing I'm wondering here, Larry, you mentioned something there about shedding skin, and I feel like so much of what we're experiencing in the West now about the dislocation of our economy, how many people are being driven out of the mainstream of our economy, is almost a reflection upon how many people in the rest of the world have actually risen up. So there's almost like a global equalization that's happening, and the people that suffer those effects most noticeably in the West are those that have had the benefits being borne by people out of the area. So we've borne the benefits of the labors done by people in other areas, and suddenly that whole paradigm has shifted. There's middle classes evolving in China and in India, as I mentioned, in Brazil, and that seems to really be shaking the pot here, really, really messing up our system as we know it.
And that's part and parcel of the change exactly that we've been talking about, that these things are not independent things. They're tied together. The thing that all of these movements are really not taking into account is everything in all of these economies is based on continuous growth. And the thing that you're citing in the limits to growth is to say we live in a finite world. There is nothing infinite in this world other than ideas.
Larry, one of the also the features of the current way of doing things is the fact that the era of cheap oil has allowed us to get so many resources to outsource labor to other countries, to import a lot of commodities, foods, whatever, because the costs of shipping have been so low as a result of the cheap oil. And all of that's going to change as our supply lines become increasingly costly to maintain. And it sort of feeds into your idea of relocalizing and this ability to do things more at home. And I was recently reading an interesting article about 3D printing, that, in fact, manufacturing is going to become increasingly localized. Is that technology, the ability to basically print out manufactured goods, becomes something that communities can avail themselves of.
Right. And one thing I want to point out, there are people who say, well, do you just want to go back to the Middle Ages? And, you know, a lot of people have this idea that somehow, you know, a transition movement requires us going back to, you know, the primitive times. We can maintain our technology, much of the technology we have, if we reduce our consumption and kind of rethink the way we do our lives. But a good example of something that is unsupportable is suburbia. The idea that we have of a suburban lifestyle is completely unsupportable in a world of peak oil. Now, if you look at Europe, where people live in much more condensed and clustered cities, where you have, you know, more population in buildings in a single area, you have public transportation, not as much ownership of private cars, people walk, people bicycle, people take trains, and they don't travel as much as we do. They're not world travelers and going everywhere by jet everywhere. They have a good lifestyle. People in, you know, many countries, other than the economic situations that are, you know, making us all crazy right now. But the lifestyle in many of these other cultures is perfectly good, but it's much simpler than the way we live today. One of the keys to transition is to reduce consumption while improving environmental and social conditions, increasing energy security, and strengthening local economies.
And those are all such good, noble values that we should be pursuing. But I have to say, speaking as a devil's advocate for a second, I'm hearing us becoming more like those Europeans over there, which we know doesn't play well politically in this country.
Understood.
And also, we're going to, you know, a lot of us are probably sitting here going, I don't want to become an Amish living in a, you know, wagon and drawing a straw hat and having to grow a big beard. I want to keep my things.
And I'm not suggesting you have to do that. What I am suggesting is change will have to occur, and either you change or you die.
So give us a picture. So what is this? What does a successful, healthy, thriving transition town look like in an era where oil is $10 or $12 a gallon? What does that look like? Let's just say you live in...
There are communities all over the world, and there's a really large movement in Europe right now, primarily in England and also in Scandinavia and other places, where communities are moving towards this localization process. Now, I'll say this. This movement just started in 2008. So we're only 4 years into it. And so one of the earliest communities that I just returned from was Cotati. Cotati, just south of us, was one of the very early transition community that adopted this concept. They are working right now on producing more of their own food, producing more local businesses and local products, reducing their energy, you know, level, their overall carbon footprint, and beginning to kind of rethink the way they do everything. Now, Cotati is a relatively middle-class California town, but if they can do it, we can do it. And the point is, you got to start somewhere. I mean, obviously, no one is there yet, but the process has begun, and many people think we may have 20 years, but we may not. Whatever we have, we better get going.
Yeah, I think that's sort of leads into what I was just going to comment on, is that, you know, in some sense, at every level of what the transition initiatives are about, society is always transitioning. I mean,
there is no static. We're always changing.
We're always changing. I think that the point of what the initiative is about is, you know, the fact that we now have the ability to make models about the future and the impacts of the use of a finite resource, an exponentially growing use of a finite resource, that we can anticipate the likely impacts of this unsustainable use and say, well, okay, we need to hasten this transition. We need to facilitate it and guide it and direct it. And I know that in the Netherlands and across the United Kingdom and other places, again, a European example, but they're instituting policies at the national level to facilitate, you know, sort of a guided transition. This is a couple steps above the Transition Town Network, which is more of a bottom-up initiative. But it's still this like this thinking that, you know, we know that something's happening down the road that we should be prepared for. Sort of the precautionary principle in practice. You know, we know that we're not going to be able to get out of this unless we act now and act wisely. So let's do it now rather than wait for the impact.
Well, there's a beautiful quote that I heard recently. David Holmgren, who is one of the originators and he helped design the whole permaculture movement. And he said a quote that I really liked. The real issue of our age is how we make a graceful and ethical descent. And I thought that was really well put, that we want it to be a gradual descent. It doesn't have to be a crash, and it's got to be ethical. We don't want to just trash people who can't afford to do what has to be done. It's not a matter of people driving Priuses. It's a matter of the entire community getting together and figuring out how we as a community are going to survive.
And just to be clear, the descent you're talking about is the descent on the right side of that peak oil bell curve.
Correct.
So
right.
It's not a descent as a society into some sort of primitive
chaos,
condition,
Mad Max, apocalyptic.
But it's a descent off of fossil fuels because it's inevitable and into an alternative.
But, you know, the transition that I haven't heard us discuss and I think a lot of people are curious about is this renewable energy platform that seems to be the thing that's always going to come. It's always about to happen. It's happening. It's slowly picking up steam. It's actually accelerating. But very little of that technology that's necessary to sustain our culture as an energy user has been developed yet. I mean, there's so much infrastructure that requires us to build in order to have energy that's renewable.
And one of the other problems along those lines, and this is something that a lot of people don't take into consideration, you need an industrial society that has all of these energy inputs to be able to build the stuff. You cannot build a photovoltaic cell in your backyard. You can't do it with an oven. You need a very high-level technology to build the tools to do this. Now, we have that infrastructure still in place, but as we start getting into what's called entropy, where things start falling apart, so we start losing some of the energy intensity that we have, we may start losing that ability to manufacture and to build these kind of things. So the sooner we get ourselves into a transition period, the better we are in the long run. There are many scenarios, but there's basically four primary scenarios that are looked at. One is considered a techno-fantasy, where everything's going to be great because we're going to invent fusion, and nuclear fusion will save the day. Well, that may happen, but I don't know what the likelihood is. There's what's called green tech stability, where we will green our way to the future, and many of us think that that's not realistic either. Then there's people who think we're just going to crash. And I'm not going to call it Mad Max, but I'll definitely call it a dystopian crash where just everything goes bad real quick. And if you want to get a sense of that, look at what happened to the Soviet Union when it collapsed. People were selling their goods in the street to survive.
And what is the fourth one?
And the best one, and the one that we're moving towards, is what we call a creative descent. And the creative descent is to plan ahead and start working this transition to slowly ratchet our energy intensity down so that we produce more of what we need locally, we consume less, and we all together as a community try to cushion the fall.
Hey, Larry, we're just about out of time, and I want to give you the chance to let people know if they're interested in becoming involved.
Yes.
With the organization or other activities that might be going on related to
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. We have a Facebook page called Humboldt Village. It's open to anyone. Go on Facebook, look up Humboldt Village, and join. All of our discussions are taking place there. And then we have an event coming up in a little over a week. And on the 28th, at the end of the month, it's going to be over at the Sunny Bray Coffee Break, and it's at 7 p.m. We're going to be showing a movie about transition. We're showing a movie called Transition 1.0, and to tell you the truth, I think this is going to be a very important meeting, because this is where we want to kick off the idea of a transition initiative up here. And so it's free to the public. Come on by, have a cup of coffee, watch this video, and we're going to talk about it. This idea is called Humboldt Village Talks. We're doing this once a month now, where we're going to have these videos and discussions. And here's a chance for anyone in the audience to come, listen to what we have to say, we'll discuss it, and we'd love to hear your ideas.
One more time with the date and the time and location.
The 28th of February. That's about a week away. It's a Tuesday night. It's 7 p.m. Coffee break, which is across from Murphy's Market. It's a little coffee shop with a drive-through and a seating area inside. And so we meet there, and we'll be showing a video of Transition 1.0. We'd love to have you come join us.
All right, Larry, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, that is the Econ News Report this week. I've been your host, Kirk Cahoon, here with David Narum of Greenway Partners. We were speaking today with Larry Goldberg, a community facilitator with the Transition Initiative, Humboldt
Village.
If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archived programs at khsu.org. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU and KHSR for the Eco News Report.